Northwest Abnormal is a true crime podcast. The subject matter may not be suitable for all listeners and is not meant for children. Discretion is advised.
Welcome to Northwest Abnormal, a true crime podcast featuring stories from the Pacific Northwest. I'm Megan, and my husband John is here to watch over me.
Hello, everybody.
Get your passport ready, because today we're going to Canada.
Yeah, and you have to have passports now. That sucks.
This is our first story involving our neighbors to the north, but it will not be the last because folks up there have no dearth of crimes and mysteries. First, a little background before we dive into the story. Babysitters exert a certain mystique on the North American cultural imagination. Most adults have memories of their babysitters throughout childhood, and many were themselves charged with caring for children whom they were not related to during adolescence. Maybe you had a crush on a certain girl who watched you while your parents went out to dinner once a month. Maybe you wept as your parents left, anxious that they might never return. The unique position as babysitter is fraught with tropes. The nubile vixen who might lure a husband away from an unsuspecting wife. The naive do-gooder angling for extra spending money, the closeted power monger quietly lording control over innocent children, or worst of all, someone intent on kidnapping or harming the child or children. And beneath and beyond this, the mythic archetypal stand-in for the mother figure, a doppelganger, the inverse of the changeling. She might replace the mother, she might deceive, she might even eat the children. In film, the babysitter is often portrayed as vulnerable, helpless, stalked, harassed by strange noises, prank phone calls, the silhouette of a man in the window, the egregious irony of a young woman tasked with caring for and protecting the little ones when she can't even defend herself against predators and the world at large. Grade school slumber parties usually entail a distinct time set aside late at night devoted to telling ghost stories, scary stories, urban legends, cautionary tales. At least they did when I was a kid. Usually these stories include the foaf, or friend of a friend. They begin with something like, "You'll never believe what happened to my aunt's friend," or "I swear this is true, it happened to my neighbor's cousin." It's often difficult to source these apocryphal legends to their origin. And yet sometimes we do, as in the case of poisoned Halloween candy or the storyline in the 2009 documentary Cropsy. Certain stories are true, and their inception rests in something that actually happened. Others are not true in the literal sense, but resonate deeply within the recesses of our ties to blood memory, ancestral or inherited trauma, and whatever grooves have impressed themselves on the Akashic records. I also just want to mention the illustrious Babysitters Club series by Anne M. Martin, which I partook of rampantly as a girl and tween, and the podcast The Babysitters Club with Jack Shepherd and Tanner Greenring, in which they psychoanalyze the book series. Can recommend.
Burn of the week.
That's the origin of that for me. There's also a book I read in grade school called Babysitting is a Dangerous Job by Willow Davis Roberts. I recommend all her books, particularly The View from the Cherry Tree and Don't Hurt Lori. This is also probably my only opportunity to plug books by Mary Downing Hahn, especially Wait Till Helen Comes, and the stupendously titled The Old Willis Place. Will you say the title of that book in the way that you think it should be said?
The Old Willis Place.
Thank you. Let's not forget When a Stranger Calls, the movie featuring Carol Kane, and Adventures in Babysitting with Elizabeth Shue, or the wonderful This American Life episode dedicated to stories about babysitting. If you haven't listened to it, it's episode 175.
You forgot about Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
You're totally right. And how can I forget?
It's classic.
Christina Applegate. The dishes are done, man. I remember some of our babysitters growing up. It was the 1980s in Seattle. There were the cool babysitters who couldn't be bothered and the pretty ones. A favorite named Maggie, who lived across the street from us, and whom my family still keeps in touch with almost 40 years later. There was the one who tickle tortured us. I didn't like her or her inability to respond when we pleaded with her to stop. And then the one who stole my mom's jewelry.
Ooh, ouch.
The thief babysitter may also have been the tickler, but I'd have to verify with my parents' siblings.
Yeah.
I wonder if my parents ever confronted her.
Good question.
That is so crunch. At age 11, I began babysitting, and I kept it up until I moved away for college 7 years later. I loved it. I took care of so many kids over those years, and in late grade school, even got to skip going to mass so that my bestie and I could watch the littles while their parents were in church. I love the weirdness and candor of children. I feel flattered when they let me into their worlds, when they deem me funny, cool, and creative enough to hang out with them. Babysitters are distinct from nannies and au pairs. When I think of a babysitter in a traditional sense, it's always an adolescent or teenage girl, which is probably why I find it so strange when I see a grown man out in public with a child or children and hear someone ask the man if he's, quote, babysitting.
But I got that last week.
I know. Man, woman, or non-binary, if it's your kid, you're not babysitting.
Don't ask a man if he's babysitting, because that's just completely uncalled for. When you're a dad, you're not a babysitter.
I wonder if it's... So was the person who said this to you also a man?
Yes.
Were they older?
No, I think he was my age.
Okay.
I'm just like, no, it's not called babysit. Like, my wife doesn't pay me to take care of my child.
Right. And God knows I never got paid when I was by myself alone with our child during lockdown for 2 years. Anyway, the compelling lore surrounding babysitters obviously fascinates me and is one of the reasons why this case grabbed me. I got a lot of information from a podcast called Crime Beat, hosted by a Canadian woman named Nancy Hickst, who's also a crime reporter for Global News. She was 5 years old when the crime we're going to discuss took place, and she feels a personal connection to it since she lived just 30 minutes away, and because it spoke directly to a fear that many children contend with, being abducted by a stranger.
Yeah.
On with our story. Standard is a small town in the province of Alberta, Canada. And when I say small town, I mean it has a population of less than 400 and is more of a village, what I imagine to be a paper town on a map. It's an hour's drive northeast of Calgary and 160 miles or 257 kilometers from the U.S. border into Montana. Its main industries are agriculture and energy from oil and gas. Everyone knew everyone, and if a stranger came through, people noticed. The area had been settled by Danish immigrants, and a common surname was Christensen. Posted that because it's significant. Despite its tiny population, babysitters were in demand. It's early spring 1981. A man calls the principal of the Standard School, the only one in the community which ran from kindergarten to senior year of high school. When the principal got on the line, a man told him that his name was Bill Christensen and asked for information regarding a 17-year-old student whom we'll call Susan. This is not her real name, and we'll get to why we're using a pseudonym later. The man wanted Susan's home address. Nowadays, we know not to disclose information when some rando calls a school or a workplace looking for someone or personal details about them. But it's the early 80s in rural Alberta. Also, the principal knew that Susan was a popular babysitter in the area, and he assumed that Christensen was calling about that. Maybe word had gotten around about her services, and he was just inquiring. That his last name was Christensen lent an air of familiarity and normalcy to his query. The principal knew people by that last name, but he was puzzled because he didn't know anyone named Bill Christensen. This gave him enough pause to get more details from Mr. Christensen, and when he pressed for them, the man hung up. The principal blew it off and moved on with his day.
Still.
I'm weirdly applauding the principal.
Yeah, I mean.
That he was like, something about this just doesn't sit right.
Yeah.
Whatever, moving on. A month and a half later, over Easter weekend, on the afternoon of Saturday, April 18th, 1981, Susan gets a phone call at home. It's Bill Christensen. No thanks to her school principal, Bill managed to get her number. Bill asks Susan if she could babysit for him and his wife that night. Ordinarily, Susan would have leapt at the chance, but it was short notice and she already had plans for the evening. She was going to her boyfriend's that night for an Easter dinner with him and his family. Bill asked if she knew of anyone who might be available. Wanting to be accommodating, as girls are raised to be, she volunteers the names and phone numbers of two other local girls. We don't know the name of one girl. The other was named Kelly Cook. 15-year-old Kelly Jane Evelyn Cook was a slim blue-eyed girl with brown hair cut in the style inspired by Dorothy Hamill. Do you remember that?
No.
It's sort of like a feathered bowl cut, but it was hugely popular from the figure skater.
Oh, I don't remember it.
Late 70s, early 80s. It was everywhere.
I mean, I was huge into figure skating at that time.
I know. When you were one or two years old. Yeah.
But.
Well, this time you would have just had your first birthday. Kelly was born in Montreal. Her father worked for an oil and gas company, and they moved several times before landing in Standard 3 years before when Kelly was 12. She lived with her parents, Marion and Walter, her younger sister, Marnie, and her little brother, Heath. People referred to Kelly as an old soul. I have been called that. I used to think it was a good thing, but lately I've been learning that this type of thing is possibly a trauma response and comes from a need to anticipate and take care of other people's needs and feelings.
Sure.
Kelly could hold her own in conversations with grown-ups. She took an interest in social justice, and she loved Nancy Drew books. She was a good student, smart and ambitious. Her mother, Marion Cook, said that from the time she was little, she was, quote, 3 going on 90. I think in reference to her precocious wisdom and maturity. Kelly wanted to be a lawyer, but she was also just a kid. She loved bike riding, figure skating, and slumber parties. She loved the TV show Dallas.
Nice.
So classic. At 15, she developed an interest in boys and confided in her sister Marnie about whom she had a crush on. She'd also recently got her learner's permit and couldn't wait to drive. On Wednesday, April 22nd, 1981, someone called the Cook home around 8:15 a.m. Kelly was getting ready to go to school. When she answered, no one responded, so she hung up. The phone rang again a few minutes later, just before she was on her way out the door. She picked it up, and a man introduced himself as Bill Christensen. This is 4 days after he had called Susan, and about 6 weeks after he had called the school for information on Susan. He told Kelly that he was looking for a babysitter for that evening and that he'd been referred to her. He needed someone from 8:30 to midnight. Those feel like late start and end times, especially on a weeknight.
Yeah.
Kelly asked her mom, Marion, if she could go. Marion wasn't crazy about Kelly babysitting on a school night, but Kelly really wanted to do it and assure her mom that she was caught up on schoolwork, so Marion said she could. But Marion wanted more information about this guy, so she asked Kelly to verify that her classmates and people in town knew who he was. Other students said they did, and they said he lived near town. This part is strange to me. Residents knew people with that surname, but did they know Bill specifically?
Probably not.
Who did they think they were talking about? Like, it was vague, like, yeah, we know that guy, but nothing solid. But do you think that people kind of do that in a small town where they claim to be in the know? Like, they're trying to act like they're just knowledgeable about the inner workings of the community?
Or? I think people do that everywhere.
Yeah.
For the most part. Actually, I think that you're right that it is more of a small town thing.
Right. Kelly told Bill she could babysit because she gets the call. She gets the hangout call. She gets the call in the morning. And then she's like, I think so. But I don't know that they ever talked again to confirm, or if all in that second call where they talked, he was like, great, what's your address? I'll be there at 8:30 tonight. And then if her mom had said no, then they would have had to tell Bill, like, no, not happening.
Right.
Because it all happened on the same day. Right? She gets the call in the morning. She asks her mom. Her mom's like, oh, I don't feel great about it. Ask around to school today. She does. And then I think she does not talk to Bill again. And it's just unknown that he's going to show up that evening.
So what's the plan? He's going to bring the kids to her?
No, the plan is he's going to pick her up. to take to his house to babysit his kids when his wife go out.
Yeah, okay. I feel bad about this.
What do you mean? Well, it's a true crime podcast.
I know, but still, like...
It stinks.
Yeah, it stinks.
It doesn't feel right. So he said he'd pick her up that night around 8:30 p.m. Her dad, Walter, came home from work as she was preparing to leave. A man rolls up in front of Kelly's house right on time. As she's on her way out, Marion said they should wait for him to come to the door. Kelly said that wasn't the norm anymore, implying that it was too old-fashioned and that she was grown up enough to go without Marion meeting this stranger or getting a chance to check him out.
Yeah, no, mom had the right instincts.
Yep. Kelly told Marion that she would call her later and left. Kelly's sister Marnie was in the basement and looked out the window as her sister walked outside and got into the car. She watched her sister ride away. It was dark by that time, 8:30 in Alberta in April. The porch light was already on. Kelly and Marnie always called home when they got to a house to babysit so that Marion would know they'd gotten there in one piece. Marion and Walter waited for Kelly's call, but it didn't come. Marion knew something was wrong. After an hour, she started making phone calls. She racked her mind for anyone who might know this Bill Christensen and called people from the post office, the bank, and the co-op. Or what I imagined was the grocery store, like a feed store, right?
Right.
Because she figured that they would know if anyone was new in town and had come by to set up accounts in postal service. But each of them said no.
Yuck.
By the time Marnie went to bed, so that's the younger sister, at 10:30, Marion was still making phone calls. Marion knew in her gut that it was bad. She couldn't imagine how bad, but it was completely out of character for Kelly to not have called. What were Marion and Walter supposed to do?
They didn't get the address.
I don't phone number or anything. Sick to my stomach. I hate all of this.
I don't blame them. I think it was just an oversight.
But it's also that I don't like the feel of this.
Yeah.
But I'm being overprotective.
Well, it's so galling that somebody would use this method.
Mm-hmm.
It's so personal.
Just out and out predation.
Yeah.
And manipulation of people's trust.
Hey, do you have a young girl at your house that could come to my house that I could steal? Mm-hmm. Great.
Mm-hmm. I picture the cooks waiting. They were beside themselves. I'm sure they clung to hope that it was some fluke. But midnight came and went, and she was supposed to be home at midnight or a little after. And Kelly didn't come home, so they called the police. The nearest RCMP, or Royal Canadian Mounted Police outpost, was almost a half-hour drive away in Strathmore. When a constable arrived, Walter got in the car with him, and they drove around literally looking in ditches. More officers drove out to the Cook home. There was no bullshit about her being a runaway or a troubled teen. No directive to wait 48 hours. Everyone took it seriously right away. Kelly hadn't taken anything with her when she left that night, no bag or purse. During a previous babysitting job, a dog had chewed through the strap of her purse, which may have been one reason why she didn't take it or anything else with her that night. Mary remembers that she'd barely worn any jewelry, just a pair of earrings. So I guess she had been out with her earlier that day or the day before, and Kelly had eaten like a puff pastry and had like an allergic reaction. So she kind of swelled up, took all of her bracelets or anything else she might have been wearing off because it was uncomfortable, but she still was wearing this pair of earrings. What strikes me about this story is how quickly people, including law enforcement, understood the gravity of the situation. The police got the story into the media. They cautioned people to be on the lookout and to stay safe since the perpetrator may be living among them. Over 300 people from Standard and nearby towns formed search parties to look for Kelly amid the rural farmland. Helicopters flew overhead. It was all hands on deck. They wanted to comb a 1,000-square-mile area to find her.
Wow.
They searched fields, barns, culverts, outbuildings, everywhere they could think of. Officers set up roadblocks around the perimeter of town and searched every vehicle that came and went. They interviewed each person they stopped. People flooded the Cook family with sympathy cards. A few days after Kelly's abduction, they received a card that stood out. Marion opened it. Someone had written in all uppercase, and the message implied that Kelly wasn't alive. They had signed it Sick Stewart.
Oh, geez.
The Cooks didn't know a Stewart, but just like the name Bill Christensen, there's no way that the abductor's name was Stewart. The family gave the card to the police. They couldn't shake how creepy it was. They were already living in darkness, and then this ominous card shows up. The Cooks had no reason to believe that Kelly was truly gone, but the card, with its foreboding message, shook their confidence that they might get her back.
Do we still not know what the message was?
I could not find exactly what the message said.
So either the police never released it, or it was just not part of the court case, or I don't even know if this is solved, so...
You'll find out. In an interview, Marion intimated that they received all manner of strange letters, ones that she can't bring herself to ever read again. Her daughter Marnie said, quote, it was social media 37 years ago. I think that she said that in like 2018 or 2019. But it just filled me with so much anxiety. Can you imagine having a missing child and all these crackpots decide to harass you? Haters, trolls, broken people, or just misguided ones who have no sense of empathy or even basic etiquette. I remember my mom telling me when my cousin had died, my aunt got the most atrocious, absurd messages from people on Facebook.
Really?
Strangers. Yeah. Yeah.
It's terrible.
I know. It's just beyond senseless. After that first eerie card, the RCMP screened the Cook's phone and mail. Walter and Marion gave interviews, and Walter would speak directly into the camera and to Kelly in case she might be watching. And he assured his daughter that they were doing everything in their power to find her. Weeks pass. The case founders. No sign of Kelly or what happened to her. Detectives continued to post up at the cookhouse, intent on finding answers. Mediums started calling and showing up at the house, giving instructions to look in certain buildings. And they would follow these. If someone said to look at a red barn, they looked in everyone they could find. They had to turn over every rock. Who can move on and get back to life as usual when your beloved is missing and you don't know what happened to them?
Completely.
Hell or high water, you must check out any last thing that someone suggests. Marion trusted that these psychics wanted to help. She felt that they were sincere and she took them seriously. I would have too.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that you're not really trusting of someone who claims to be a medium. I understand the skepticism, but if we were, God forbid, in a position like that, I would believe anyone and just need someone to tell me what the fuck was going on.
I think that's a problem. That's why it's so easy for those people to prey on people.
Yeah. Marion talked about one psychic who didn't speak English, but who had a Japanese interpreter. She gave a few details of where she thought Kelly was. Before the woman left, she put her hand on Marion, patted her, and said, you're thinking one way, but it's the other.
What does that mean?
I take to mean that the medium could tell Marion how that hope that Kelly was alive, but that she, the medium, sensed that Kelly was already gone.
Yeah.
Walter and Marion kept the porch light on in the days and weeks after Kelly vanished. The RCMP looked up Bill Christensen's all over Canada. Unsurprisingly, many men by that name populated the country. Kind of like trying to find the right John Smith in the U.S. And thankfully, they understood that it had to be a pseudonym. Weeks into the investigation, a promising lead comes when a phone operator based in Calgary, again, this is about an hour's drive west of Standard. So this phone operator had seen coverage of Kelly's case on the news and called one of the investigators. The operator told him that on April 22nd, 1981, the night Kelly disappeared, she received a call from a payphone in Hazar, which is a town about 20 minutes southeast of Standard, and that the call came in between 10 and 10:30 p.m., which would have been an hour and a half or 2 hours after Kelly got into the car.
Okay.
She said she heard a girl screaming and that the sound was so loud she took her headset off. When she put it back on, the caller had hung up. Whoever is pretending to be Bill Christensen is a sadist. To not only abduct a girl under the pretenses of the babysitting thing, but then to send a menacing card to the family in the days after, and then to also call a phone operator on the night of the crime so that a third party has to listen in on another human being and that human being's distress because they are being tortured or at the very least held against their will.
Yeah.
When Marion heard about this phone call, it put her over the edge. She believed this operator's account and that the screaming that the woman heard came from her daughter. Not only is this beyond horrifying, but it also doesn't get us any closer to where Kelly is or who took her. Then another person comes forward, someone who might know who Bill Christensen really is. It's a local gas station owner. Per an investigator, it was a manager, but we're going to go with owner to keep it simple. And I believe this station is in Standard or on its outskirts. He thinks he may have seen, quote unquote, Bill, and may have seen him while he made the payphone call on the morning of April 22nd, the call he made to Kelly.
Okay.
We're going to call him Dwayne, the gas station guy.
Okay.
Dwayne also thinks he knows why whoever called Kelly that morning hung up on the first call. Do you remember how she picked up and the other person hung up? And then a few minutes later, somebody called again.
I missed that.
Okay. The morning she took the babysitting gig, someone calls, she picks up, no one answers, so she hangs up. And a few minutes later, somebody calls, and it's Bill Christensen.
Okay.
Dwayne explains that the way the phones worked, you would dial a number, the other party would answer, and then you would insert your coin or coins.
Okay.
After the other party answered. But he surmises that this man put his coin in first and therefore the call disconnected. This and a couple other details make me wonder if the man wasn't from Canada, but from the US.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if all Canadian payphones worked that way in the early 80s, but I know that in the US, we always used to put the coin in first, right?
Or
the
coin totally. First. Payphones, kids. It was a thing.
No, I didn't want to be condescending. The younger listeners.
Like, I don't mind.
You know, like, oh, you've probably never heard of this thing called landlines. So Stranger Danger walks into the gas station and asks Dwayne if he can use the landline. Hey, there it is. After a disconnected call on the outside payphone, Dwayne said that this man talked to him about getting a babysitter.
Okay.
And why are you flapping your trap about weird shit?
Good.
To Thank Dwayne. Goodness he did. Do you think it might be our elusive and falsely named Bill Christensen?
Yeah.
I fucking do. Dwayne lets the guy make a phone call, but watches while he dials to make sure that he's not calling long distance. He'd been burned by his past generosity with the phone, and it used to be expensive to make long-distance calls back in the day of those relics landlines. Mm-hmm. Dwayne gave a detailed description of whom he saw. Dwayne said that the man looked like a farmer. Okay. You and I live in a rural agricultural area. I've met several farmers.
Sure.
Some are short, some are tall, some are fat, some are skinny. Some look rugged. The older ones look distinguished.
Sure.
You know the way men grow distinguished and more handsome as they age, but women become hormonal hags at menopause and then devolve into sexless, raging, and yet somehow serene Buddha-like mutants?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I do. Dwayne also said the man had curly dark hair. He had a fair but tan skin tone, around 5'9 and 190 pounds with a good build, good posture, and no beer belly. No limp or distinctive gait. His hands were large and stained from work, but not clearly clean or dirty. Dwayne pegged him as in his 40s and said his teeth were stained, possibly from nicotine, though the man didn't smoke during his visit. The man was handsome, but Dwayne described his eyes as sunken in.
Right.
Do what you will with that. He had thick, dark eyebrows, no hat or glasses. He wasn't well-dressed, but he also wasn't a TLC-defined scrub. Maybe a denim jacket, dark-colored pants.
Okay.
Dwayne said that his impression that this person might be a farmer came from his sense that whomever he was talking to on the phone, we can assume it was Kelly, he sounded like he knew the person. On June 28th, 1981, just over 2 months after Kelly didn't come home, a young man riding his motorbike with friends found her remains at the Chain Lakes Reservoir, a 2.5-hour drive south of Standard. Whoever put Kelly there went to great lengths to conceal her, and didn't know the area would experience a drought and reveal her body when the water level fell. Two concrete blocks were tied to Kelly's body with a rope. RCMP officers went to her dad Walter's workplace and told him that someone had found Kelly's body. They told Walter to go home to tell Marion, Marnie, and Heath, because word had already spread, and if he didn't tell his family, chances were they might learn it through news radio. A colleague drove Walter to the house. It was so unusual for Walter to be home in the middle of a weekday that at least Marnie, Kelly's sister, was certain what it meant when she saw her father approach the house. He told them what they already knew. In the middle of the afternoon, Marion walked over and turned the porch light off.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
The symbolism of this makes me ache. We always keep a light on for our children, no matter how old they get. We offer warmth, nourishment, protection, and comfort to our kids for as long as they will let us. What do you do with this desire and compelling need to give when your child is gone and they're not supposed to be gone? The light went out for Marion Cook when she learned that her daughter was definitely dead. She automatically, maybe in a hypnotic state, turned off the porch light when she learned that Kelly was never coming home. This gesture is so simple, and yet one of the most authentic and understandable responses to the impossibility of grief that I've ever heard in a story. I don't know how she went on. I don't know how you learn that your child is dead and you keep living. Marion noted that her wedding anniversary with Walter was the day after Kelly was found. That was the day they were notified on their wedding anniversary.
Oh, that sucks.
Kelly's remains were so badly decomposed that an examiner used dental records to identify her. It was so difficult for Marion to accept that it was Kelly that an investigator asked Marion if she would recognize Kelly's earrings, ones found on the deceased. She said yes. When he passed the earrings across the table to her, she knew it was her daughter. Until the very last, how can you not believe it's some mistake or nightmare? Marion had known before, but now she really knew. After Kelly was found, Marion realized that the Japanese medium had been spot on in so much of what she had told her about the body of water, about there being frogs nearby. Marion said the only thing she got wrong was the exact location of where Kelly's remains were found. The only thing the medium had gotten wrong was the direction of the body of water from Standard. I cannot wrap my head around this next part.
Okay.
People planned Kelly's funeral, but police didn't want her family to see her body because of the condition it was in.
Well, yeah, of course.
They didn't want that to be their last memory of Kelly. I understand having someone else ID Kelly's body, but no one in her family even went to the funeral.
Well, what? Why?
I don't know. I'm
do a closed casket. That's what you do.
Thank you. I'm going to tell you more of what I understand, but I listened to this other podcast, Crime Beat, and I had to listen to this section 4 times. I'll tell you my hypothesis after I get through this next little section, because it will never make sense to me. Okay, so
the funeral is for the family.
Thank you. I know. So they didn't go to the funeral. Nothing I read or heard indicated the Cook family's religion or whether they were even religious. If seeing the body was the issue, why not have a closed casket? Which is exactly what you just said. So one of Kelly's friend's dads picked out the casket and made some of the arrangements. So here's my thing. I know it's Canada, and I know that we speak English among other languages in the U.S., and they speak English among other languages in Canada. But I wonder if there are nuanced weirdnesses. Like, you know how in British English, like, they'll pluralize math so that it's maths? Or they'll say, like, she went to hospital instead of went to the hospital?
Sure.
I wonder if it's a quirk like that, because I almost felt like when Marion and Nancy Hickst were talking and recording their interview, that there was a conflation between IDing the body and funeral.
Well, I wonder if they had a private funeral for the family.
No, they didn't. It was a huge, it was like wherever they held it, it was at capacity. There were just people
everywhere. I get that. But then you would go and visit the casket after everyone was gone, or visit the gravesite and have your own funeral after
everybody. You're speaking my language. I don't understand.
They have to have Like, at least they visit the gravesite all together and they talk about it.
But
right?
It got me thinking. Marion was like, all right, well, she was ID'd by dental records, but how can we really know? And I get that. But it's also a last bid to be like, this can't be real. It's not denial. It's something deeper than denial. It's something different, I think. This made me think, though, that it's an impossible calculus when it comes to the identification of a deceased loved one. If you see them in death, you may be haunted by that image and it will dominate over other memories that you have of them from when they were alive.
Yeah.
But if you don't see the body, you may be haunted by never being certain that it really is your loved one.
Yeah, totally.
Again, I don't understand not going to the funeral. I think the ritual of an official mourning day is essential and is an ancient part of us to formally honor and bury our dead.
Yes.
And maybe I misinterpreted it, or maybe the way that interview was edited, it made it sound like the family did not go. And Nancy Hicks straight up says, so no one in the family went to the funeral. And she's like, right, nobody went. I sense that law enforcement convinced the family not to go, and that will never make sense to me. They were so grief-stricken, vulnerable, and exhausted, and maybe they just trusted that it was in their best interest not to attend.
Yeah, I don't understand it.
I don't get it either. On July 2nd, 4 days after the motorcyclist found Kelly's body, a strange man visited the funeral home where her body was in repose. He said he was friends with the family, and he asked to see her body.
Okay.
Whoever was working was like, no, you can't see her body. The man got agitated and then left. Who besides her killer would do this?
Nobody.
The worker at the funeral home didn't report it right away, so there was no way for police to track him down and question him. Two of the workers described him for a sketch to be drawn up, but their descriptions varied. If I had to stake my life on it, that man was the one from the gas station and the man calling himself Bill Christensen and the man who murdered Kelly.
Yeah, 100%.
If those workers had sounded the alarm, this could have solved the case. It makes me wonder if funeral home workers are apprised of how someone dies. I would think they would be.
Well, that small a town, they would know.
But maybe it was like the next town over. But this was like everywhere in the news. Yeah. And that they know her name or totally. the first or last name. If you worked there and helped prepare a body and you knew this person had been murdered and some schmo walks in off the street and asks to see her, you're going to stall and pass a note to your coworker to do something. Okay.
I am going to take this guy's picture and tail him out of the parking lot.
You were going to stall. You're going to pass a note to your coworker or do something shifty with your eyes to communicate to them to call the police. Oh, hi, sir.
I might even be like, hey, sure. And we've got some other bodies. You want to just look around?
No, no, that's not what I'm saying.
Keep him there.
I would be like, yes, come with me, sir. Don't let him see the body. Come back here with me. Let him go first and then turn around and mouth to your coworker, call the fucking police immediately.
Yeah. Eh?
Eh? We had to get it in. How do you spell Canada?
No.
I know. Sorry, sorry.
So he...
just not that. Gone with the wind.
Fuck.
Gone with the wind or gone like the wind?
Well, with is the movie.
You're right. Weird. Do people say gone with the wind?
No.
Do they say gone like the wind?
No. You just did. It made sense.
So weird. Okay. Anyway. This is horrible. I'm laughing and this is awful.
Well, you got to break the tension.
Kelly's funeral was held the following day, July 3rd, 1981, and her family wasn't there, from my understanding. And now the work of a homicide investigation begins. It doesn't take a seasoned detective to realize that this was premeditated or that Bill Christensen wasn't the murderer's real name. Also, the choice of that surname was strategic. He chose it knowing that it would lower anyone's guard or disarm them with its feigned intimacy. So calculated. RCMP officers working out of Calgary brought the case to the FBI in July 1981, so probably in the weeks after the funeral. At Quantico, Roy Hazelwood, a special agent and maverick in behavioral science and criminal profiling, looked at the whole case, including pictures and information that was never released to the public. FBI agents put together a profile on the subject. Profiling was new and a soft science, and for some Canadian officers, it felt a little too soft. The profile included speculation that the perp was divorced, that the breakup was acrimonious, and that he had physically abused his wife during the marriage and would have a public record of intimate partner violence. The offender likely grew up with a broken family or one defined by familial discord. He may have lost a parent early in life. His family was probably middle class, but that's a broad spectrum.
Yeah.
I can't get over the audacity of this man driving up to a house and picking up a 15-year-old under the guise of taking her to babysit your kids.
Completely. And it makes me wonder if the mom had just stuck to her guns, if he would have actually come to the door, or if
he would have driven off. I hate it. I grew up in a neighborhood in Seattle that was a short drive from downtown, but was really set apart from the rest of the city to the west on Puget Sound, right? Anytime I had a new family to babysit for, my parents didn't necessarily vet the family. They either knew the other parents as acquaintances, knew people in common, or the other family went to our church or my grade school.
Sure.
This story stands out for how devious this man's trap was. He relied on a community's sense of security, and it worked.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah, it's so tragic.
It's just also a study in how we deny our instincts.
Yeah.
Detectives asked the public for help in solving the case. They worked unpaid overtime. A $40,000 reward was put up for any information leading to the killer. The money came from the cooks and from donations from their friends, local businesses, and random citizens who mailed cash to the family. Sometime in 1982, several months to a year after Kelly was killed, a man named Robert Brown confessed to murdering Kelly.
Really? What's the circumstance? Was he caught doing something? What? Give me there.
Brown was being interviewed as a suspect for the sexual assaults and murders of two young women named Lori Boyd and Debbie Stevens in December 1981 and January 1982. During the interrogation, he said he murdered Kelly. Detectives lit up with adrenaline and a sense of victory, thinking they had their guy. But after 3 days of looking into Robert Brown, they found an alibi for him that irrefutably eliminated him. Brown finally admitted that he was just jerking their chain. But he was later found guilty, along with a man named James Edward Peters, in the sexual violence against and the murders of Lori Boyd and Debbie Stevens. Brown's fake confession for abducting Kelly was the first in a series that law enforcement received during their investigation. Just as some cases go cold because of limited leads, Kelly's had the opposite problem, too many. When cops had released a composite sketch based on Dwayne, the gas station guy's description, it was so nonspecific that scores of people emerged with tips. They had to follow up on over 2,000 leads, which meant that they devoted most of their resources to chasing those down instead of on other evidence and information. They had scores of suspects, but no one promising enough to charge or indict. Investigators looked all over Canada and visited penitentiaries to interview people, including Clifford Olson, an infamous killer who preyed on children. One reason they knew Olson didn't murder Kelly is because he was convicted of killing a 16-year-old boy in Vancouver, BC, the night Kelly went missing.
Wow.
That's not comforting.
No.
Marion tracked every article written about Kelly and every photo published, any ephemera related to her daughter's death. She tried to shield Marnie and Heath from this press coverage, but she needed to collect it. She compiled everything into an album, one that she can't stand to look at now, but Marnie has it. Kelly's dad, Walter, died in 2007. He was 70 years old, and he passed away without knowing who took Kelly, without a sense of justice or vengeance. Over the years, attention has developed for Kelly's family, to welcome media attention or not. Spotlighting Kelly's case could bring much-needed answers. The trade-off is that all the nut jobs come out of the woodwork. But again, you don't ignore a potential lead. Just conjecture, it's the noise of the internet.
Yeah.
Imagine trying to separate the wheat from the chaff in terms of data coming at you from every direction.
Yeah.
When so much of that shit on social media is not data, it's just people's dysfunction.
Completely.
Do you remember Susan, the 17-year-old who passed along Kelly's name to Bill Christensen?
Yeah, I wonder like how bad her survivor's guilt was.
She was the original target. She still doesn't know why. In 1981, she had a reputation as a reliable and responsible babysitter. Now that we're back here, let's just do a quick refresher of early spring 1981. A man named Bill Christensen called the school principal asking for Susan's phone number. The principal knew the family name, but not someone named Bill, and this gave him enough pause to refrain from giving Susan's number to the man. As we discussed earlier, he got her number anyway and called her 6 weeks later on April 18th. She had dinner plans with her boyfriend's family that night, otherwise she would have gladly agreed. When the man asked, Susan offered names and numbers for two other local girls, and we know he switched his focus then to Kelly Cook. That disclosure torments Susan to this day. Susan was an innocent small-town girl with dreams of college who planned to fund her future with savings from childcare gigs. She was so in demand as a babysitter that families would book her out a year in advance to watch their children on New Year's Eve. She thought Kelly or the other girl would be eager to take the job Bill Christensen offered and didn't think anything of it until 5 days later when she got to school on April 23rd and heard over the intercom that Kelly Cook was missing. She was terrified and immediately went to the principal and told him about her phone call with Bill Christensen and said that she had given him Kelly's name and number. Susan remembers everything down to where she was standing in her house when he called. She remembers that he used her full name. He said that he had just moved to Standard and needed a babysitter. She knew she was unavailable that evening and told him so. He asked for another girl's contact information. Susan thought of Kelly, someone she'd figure skated with. None of it seemed out of place until that following Thursday when she heard about Kelly's disappearance and she knew it was somehow connected to Bill and her call with him the previous Saturday. Susan felt responsible for what this man did to Kelly.
Yeah, that sucks. I feel for her.
Unknowns torture her. What if this man still intended to get her? I mean, this was back then in 81, but has not gone away for her. What if the man still intended to get her? After Kelly's body was found, Susan wondered if she was next. She realized that she could have been murdered as easily and senselessly as Kelly. By some strange twist of fortune, she'd avoided walking into Bill Christensen's snare. Susan avoided media interviews, but worked closely with police, hoping to offer anything useful. She even agreed to be hypnotized to see if that might shake something loose. She moved away from Standard, but on a visit that she made in the last 5 or 6 years, she was talking about Kelly's case with former high school classmates. One of them said someone's name to her and told her that this person was after her at the time. Even they had known it back in 1981. This man also bore a strong resemblance to the original sketch of Bill Christensen. Susan wouldn't name this person for obvious reasons. She doesn't even give her own name in the interview she gave with Nancy Hickst, which was her first media interview, because her whole life she's been like, I need security cameras. I need to make it hard for anyone to find me, because she was so hounded by the media. But she says that this man, that the friend referenced, and she's like, oh yeah, I remember that guy. She said that this man had lived in Standard when she was in high school and that he was related to one of her friends. She didn't say what the relationship was, though. Before we get bent out of shape over whether this is our guy, Susan absolutely brought his name to the police. They told her he was on their list, but that he had been ruled out. But she still thinks it could be this guy. And I do too, and I feel like the police may have overlooked something.
Maybe he had a partner that was willing to give him an alibi, you know?
What do you mean a partner? Oh, right, like a girlfriend or a wife or a boyfriend or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Susan is distressed by not knowing who killed Kelly, but I think she knows who killed Kelly.
She might, or it might be nothing, like...
I know. You hear about that occasionally, though, where they eliminated someone and it's like, oh shit, that actually was him.
Yeah, for sure.
Susan has visited mediums, undergone hypnosis, and done anything and everything she can to unload her burdensome guilt. She knows intellectually that she is not responsible, but she gave Kelly's name and number to the fictitious Bill Christensen. It's so fucked up to learn after the fact that you gave a killer someone's contact info.
Yeah.
Innocently believing it was just a local dad.
That sucks.
And realizing in hindsight that if you, by happenstance, had been available, you wouldn't be here anymore.
Yeah.
And you mentioned survivor's guilt.
Completely.
It's all in it. It's fear. It's grief. It's guilt. Your life is never the same after something like that.
And dealing with that at that age, it like
17.
Yeah, it's going to be a cloud for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
You can't get away from it. Here's a thought. Maybe Susan, Kelly, and Marion all clocked that something was off since a man called to make childcare arrangements. And before anyone wants to come at me for being sexist, first of all, misogyny and sexism are at an all-time high in 2024. Second, the sexism of small-town standard in 1981 probably had a different feel and brand, but was still alive and well. Third, I just think about my own upbringing and the thought that my dad would make childcare arrangements for my parents' date nights in the 80s just does not compute. I cannot fathom my dad having been like, he wouldn't even know where to find their phone numbers probably, right? Like this sure. Is no knock. I adore my dad, but that was all my mom's wheelhouse, right? And he didn't really come near it. And maybe this is me relying too heavily on the notion that my family was quote unquote typical for the time, but I don't think so. I think that was typical. The mom just takes care of everything.
Yeah.
That when it comes to the kids. Regardless, Susan also lives with the knowledge that whoever murdered Kelly Cook intended to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. We don't know who killed Kelly.
Well, that sucks, Megan.
Susan probably does. And officers have written her input off. Not because she's wrong, but because she's a woman. I have a very strong feeling that Susan is right.
It definitely should be looked into to the end of...
the earth.
Yeah.
This story has the feel of an urban legend or a horror movie.
Yeah, totally. Talk about like turning you off of babysitting.
Oh my God. It just speaks to the archetype of a girl or young woman who wants to offer care in lieu of the parental figure. I cried a lot while writing this.
Yeah, I can see why.
Kelly Cook, her earrings.
Yeah.
One monster, the porch light. This beautiful girl, this beautiful soul snuffed out before she got to live her own life. Marion and Marnie, Kelly's mom and sister, exude warmth, love, steadfastness, and a quiet power. I want to honor the memory of Kelly Jane Evelyn Cook and the legacy of the women who know and loved her and who continue to seek the truth about what someone did to her and stole from their family. What do you think and feel, listeners? Is it possible that Susan or detectives know who killed Kelly but don't have enough to prove it? Email us at nwonpod@gmail.com. Rate, review, subscribe. Tell people about us. Tell a stranger at the grocery store. Be bold and tell your boss. It might be a bonding agent. Until next time, you do you, as long as it doesn't hurt anyone.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.